Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1041, interview number 10 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on December 18th of the year 2018, and once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airways Jim DiEugenio, the author of the triumphal Destiny Betrayed. Jim, welcome back.
Okay. Good evening, Dave. Nice to be here.
We were talking about David Ferry and his most unusual, quote, suicide, unquote, actually a berry aneurysm. And he, obviously, many people, including myself, believe he was killed. It makes no sense on its surface. But you mentioned that Ferry was expressing anxiety, fear for his life in private. And I think we should mention in that context what happened to other people who were in the Guy Bannister orbit. Ferry was one of the Bannister's, quote, investigators, unquote, and Bannister, like Ferry and others, was deeply involved not only with the anti-Castro effort in New Orleans, but with the training camps for Mongoose et al., such as the Cone. What happened to Guy Bannister?
Well, Guy Bannister died within about a year of the Kennedy assassination. He was supposedly died of a heart attack, okay, at his apartment. I think he was separated from his wife, and his body was discovered by his secretary, Delphine Roberts, all right? Hugh Ward, I think, if I remember correctly, died, who was Bannister's partner. I think he died in an airplane crash,
yes.
All right, about around the same time.
Yep.
All right.
And the mayor
so
of New Orleans.
You have Bannister, mm-hmm. Hugh Ward, Oswald, and Ferry all died within a very short period of time after the Kennedy assassination.
And I would note that in Hugh Ward's plane, another of the casualties in that was Delisa Morrison, who had been the mayor of New Orleans at that time. And
correct.
Would have
That's
known
true. Yes.
About many of the connections. I've forgotten off the top of my head, but there was an FBI-linked law enforcement institution in New Orleans with which Bannister was connected. And Morrison certainly would have known about that and about many of these people. We mentioned in an earlier interview, Jim, and perhaps we'll certainly touch back on it in connection with Clay Shaw, but Maurice Brooks Gatlin, tell us about what happened to him. I think it was in 1965.
Yeah, Maurice Brooks Gatlin, who was an attorney who was associated with Bannister in something called the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean. He was, well, take your pick. He was either pushed or fell out of, I think, a six-story window in a hotel in Panama City, Panama, around 65 or 66. Now, Gatlin is a very, very interesting character who I believe would have been an utterly fascinating witness for Jim Garrison, because this guy, see, there's some of these characters who are simply don't connect up the ladder very far. But Gatlin is one of these guys who you could have gone upward, vertical with, because he was communicating with the State Department during the lead-up to the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala, and he had links to the right wing, the radical right wing, okay, like the Minutemen, all right? And he also was involved, allegedly, with this shadowy business operation operating out of Rome called Permandex, or the Central Mondial Comercial, all right? So Gatlin was a very, very, I believe, if you're looking at the case simply as a way of getting leads, which, of course, is what detectives are looking for all the time. You know, Gatlin was a really important character, I believe.
Yeah, and you mentioned in one of our earlier interviews, and perhaps time permitting, we'll come back to this, in connection with Permendex and Cinpamamiale Commerciale, he boasted of having Ferry, pun intended, $100,000 from the CIA to the OAS plotting against the life of former French President Charles de Gaulle. So yeah, the
correct, right.
The deep politics surrounding Maurice Brooks Gatlin are more than a little interesting, and the demise of these people, I think, is important to evaluate in connection with the anxiety that David Ferry expressed in private that he would be killed because of the investigation taking place.
Correct.
And of course,
that's what he said.
Yep. And the Lobby of Del Valle then gets butchered within 24 hours. And there are just so many. Well, there is even more that we could talk about, but in connection with that. But time marches on, and I want to emphasize to the listeners, as lengthy and pedantic as this series of interviews has been, and figures to be, because we've got a long way to go, there is much, much more in the book, and I think people would do very well to get a hold of Destiny Betrayed, as we are right in the fevered part of the holiday gift-giving season. After David Ferry died, Jim, the next focal point of Garrison's investigation was a guy named Clay Shaw, a.k.a. Clay Bertrand, a.k.a. Clem Bertrand. We'll go into the aliases and some of the interesting significance of that. But Ferry and Shaw were not strangers to one another. Why don't we mention the Freeport Sulphur Company, its operations, and how the two of them associated together and with that operation, and mentioning in that context the sort of deep political or corporate and economic connections of that company. Because rather like some of the professional, some of the heritage of Michael and Ruth Payne, I think the people involved with Freeport Sulphur are more than a little interesting as we consider how David Ferry and Clay Shaw came to be associated not only with each other, but with that company's operations.
Dave, to be perfectly honest, and I'm not exaggerating at all, we could do a whole show about Freeport Sulphur, and we still wouldn't even come close to telling the whole story. We found out about this company, that is me and Lisa Peace, whose book, A Lie Too Big to Fail on the Robert Kennedy Assassination, came out this week, while we were doing a journal called Probe Magazine back in the 90s. What happened was that we uncovered some files from the House Select Committee, all right, and when they had done a little bit of an investigating of this company, all right, and we also came across Freeport Sulphur in relation to the overthrow of Sukarno in Indonesia, all right, we didn't know, have any idea what the heck were we getting into. All right, but it turned out that it was a very, very, very important lead, all right, and because it connected a large amount of very, very important people all under, so to speak, one roof, all right, and when I say a lot, I mean going all the way at the bottom, that is Ferry, okay, going all the way to the top of the entire power structure of the United States. And I'm talking about the very top. I'm talking about people like Jock Whitney, who owned the New York Herald Tribune, and the Rockefeller clan, because there were many of the Rockefeller people were on the board of directors of Freeport Sulphur, because Whitney and the Rockefellers, they were both in New York there, okay? They were very, very good friends. It was Jock Whitney who was the actual founder of Freeport Sulfur Company. Now, see, that gives you a very, very, very brief overview, okay, of what the company, of how big and how powerful the company was. But as it relates to what we're talking about right here, it turns out that as Castro began to nationalize several of the businesses inside of Cuba, all right, one of the companies that he was going to nationalize was the Moabe Mining Company, which was a subsidiary of Freeport. And this had been a very lucrative nickel company, all right, that that Freeport Sulfur had on the island. So there had to be a way to somehow find a way to salvage the money, okay, that they were about to lose in this. And so what happened is that Clay Shaw took a role in this by finding a way to go ahead and transport the nickel out of Cuba into Canada, which still had a trade agreement with Cuba, and then going ahead and refining it down in New Orleans, okay? And so there were a couple of business trips that Ferry was the pilot for, and for which Clay Shaw was the representative trying to put together this business deal with the Moabe Mining Company and these Canadian interests, right? Now, not only that, but it appears that Shaw was associating with a man named Charles White, W-I-G-H-T, who was actually thinking of contemplating an assassination plot against Fidel Castro to save the Moabe Mining Company.
By the way, Jim, right. That's spelled M-O-A Bay for people who have not.
Right, and M-O-A, Moabe Mining Company.
Right, most people have not heard the name. Go ahead, Charles
now,
White.
Now, considering the amount of money, of course, that was on the table here, and we're talking tens of millions of dollars back in 1961, okay, which would translate, you know, you're talking about at least a couple hundred million dollars today. All right, we can understand, okay, why they would be thinking of taking those drastic kind of measures, all right? Now, like I said, I could go on and on and on because, see, what happened with Freeport Sulfur is that after Castro expelled them from Cuba, all right, that they began to transfer a lot of their money and a lot of their investments to Indonesia, right? And that is a story that is really kind of incredible when you think about it. And when we did Probe Magazine, we, Lisa Pease, did a two-part essay on this subject about how Freeport Sulfur forcibly left Cuba, and then they began to expand their horizons almost unimaginably in Indonesia, but it could only be possible with the overthrow of Sukarno. And I'm sure you probably discussed that several times, right?
Oh, yeah, we have. And in fact, we even alluded to that in one of our first interviews. In fact, I think it was our first interview where the CIA had been wanting to oust Sukarno, who had taken a doctrinaire neutralist position vis-a-vis the Cold War. He had helped to coalesce a bloc of nations who we would now call the Third World, which were neither affiliated with the U.S., nor the former Soviet Union, but would take a neutral track, an independent track in the Cold War, which was absolutely anathema to the Dulles brothers, and because Sukarno also maintained a very good relationship with the Indonesian communist Persi, that also made him a bete noir to the Dulles brothers, and so they undertook to get rid of him. And Kennedy, on the other hand, was understanding of Sukarno's position, as he was in general, the positions of leaders of countries that had been colonial properties of European colonial or imperial powers and did not want to get involved in the Cold War aligning and bloodletting. And that was one of many things that pitted Kennedy on the opposite side of the court from the Dulleses and others. So, yes, absolutely. And Freeport Sulfur and Freeport Mining began transferring capital from Cuba to Indonesia. David Ferry and Clay Shaw and their involvement with Freeport Sulfur together, because that is one of the areas where we see David Ferry Garrison's first target, investigative target, and Clay Shaw, his second investigative target and the ultimate defendant in the case, working together.
Right. That's absolutely correct. All right. And I would just add that Freeport Sulfur benefited immensely, and I'm talking about immensely, from the overthrow of Sukarno in 1965, because they had an investment in something called the Grotzburg and the Erzberg, which were, I'm sure you're familiar with those. Those were two giant gold and silver and copper deposits, one in a meadow, one on a mountain, okay, which it's almost unimaginable the wealth that was in those two deposits. I would say conservatively, and I'm being very conservative, we're talking $200 million with Moa Bay, I would say that those two deposits of precious metals ended up being worth a minimum of about $25 billion, all right? And that's why it was so important for the overthrow of Sukarno in 1965 to Freeport Sulfur. It's really amazing, isn't it, the way you can make these connections, you know, the New Orleans to the Kennedy assassination to Indonesia in 1965?
Well, it is, and I think part of the one of the things to bear in mind is that we have been handed something that is not only a censored and doctored version of history, but one that has been fragmented. It is like smashing a pane of glass or a mirror. And we have been shown the fragments, and it has not been explained to us, and you have illustrated much of that, much of the original position in your book, how these shards, how these pieces actually fit together, or how the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that has been cast upon the floor, which, when painstakingly assembled, reveal a very clear and important picture, actually fit together. And that is one of the things that you have done. Again, Clay Shaw and David Ferry active on behalf of Freeport Sulfur against Fidel Castro, who had basically neutralized their operations or their Moa Bay mining subsidiary in Cuba.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
You mentioned, Jim, you go into great length, something that also brings together not only David Ferry and Clay Shaw, but brings together David Ferry, Clay Shaw, and Lee Harvey Oswald. And that is their curious presence in Clinton, Louisiana, where coincidentally there had been a voter registration drive to try and get many of the African-American residents of the Clinton area registered to vote in the context of the civil rights campaign that was going on in the early 1960s. Now, what were David Ferry and Clay Shaw and Lee Harvey Oswald doing there? And maybe perhaps in that context, mention to us the large number of witnesses who very credibly can place them together at that town and at that event.
This is, again, this is another lead that Garrison originally dug up, okay? And he went ahead and investigated it, and other people have gone ahead and built on that kind of pioneering work. And in my opinion, today, it is one of the strongest pieces of evidence that we have in this case, all right, because it puts together Clay Shaw, David Ferry, and Lee Harvey Oswald in the late fall of 1963 in a place that nobody would be able to explain. What were they doing there? All right, but the evidence is so powerful, and I'm talking about not one or two or three witnesses. I'm talking about, like, maybe over 10, maybe 15 witnesses, you know, who put these guys together in this these two little towns. One was called Clinton. One was called Jackson. And they're within about a 10-mile distance of each other, all right? Now, to go ahead and explain how this thing unfolds, you have Oswald going into a barber shop, all right, and talking to the guy manning the barber shop, a guy named Edwin McGeehee, all right? And he walks in, gets his hair cut, and at the end of the conversation, they start talking about, you know, finding a job at the hospital. There was a mental hospital there in Jackson, right? And so McGeehee said words to the effect, you might want to go see Reeves Morgan, who's a state representative, all right, for the area, and he might be able to go ahead and exercise some influence. So after he talks to McGeehee, he then goes over to the Clinton area, all right, and he knocks on Reeves Morgan's door, all right? Now, it's not just Reeves Morgan who was at home. There's also his son and his daughter, that is Van Morgan and Mary Morgan. They all three see him, all right? And I managed to talk to both Mary and Van Morgan. And this was in the 90s, and their memories were still sharp of the whole incident, all right? And we also talked to Reeves Morgan, all right? So we talked to Reeves Morgan, Van Morgan, Mary Morgan, and Edwin McGee. They were still alive in the 90s, all right? Now, Reeves Morgan said something like, it might be helpful to you if you were registered to vote, okay? So the next day, Shaw and Ferry show up in a Cadillac, all right, and they go to the registrar of voters to go ahead and try and vote, all right? What they didn't know, and this is what kind of blew the whole operation, was that the civil rights group called CORE, C-O-R-E, was holding a massive voter registration drive on that very day. So therefore, there were literally scores of people, almost all of them African Americans. Okay, and so Oswald stood out, you know, like a sore thumb, all right, in this crowd of overwhelmingly, you know, African-American people. Now, the local registrar was a guy named Henry Earl Palmer, all right? And he had the drive, he was the registrar, and he was only open for 2.5 days a week, all right? And he opened at 8:30, all right? And he goes downstairs, and he noticed this. Now, you can imagine, in a small town like this, a guy shows up in a big black Cadillac, all right, that a lot of people are going to notice the car, all right? And so Palmer went ahead and noticed the car, all right? Now, several other people saw the car there, and I named some of them in here. Andrew Dunn, James Bell, Charlotte Greenup, Verla Bell, William Dunn, all noted the car, all right? They said it stayed there for hours, right? Another guy, Robert Thomas, Edwin Lee Spears, Henry Burnell Clark, okay? So you have literally about a dozen witnesses who see these three guys, you know, this very, very odd arrangement in this big black Cadillac on the street, all right? And Clark, Henry Burnell Clark, said that he saw Shaw actually get out of the car and walk up and down the street, and he said he reminded me of a movie actor I remembered seeing on the screen, and he was unusually tall, standing well over 6 feet, all right? And in fact, when he interviewed Clark, Jim Garrison wrote on the back of a picture of Shaw, Jeff Chandler. And if you're old enough to remember, and I think you are, you know, Jeff Chandler was an actor from the 60s, all right? And, okay, and who Shaw did make a resemblance to.
Right, right.
So, in other words, literally about a dozen people are witnesses to this incident, all right? And by the way, and I'm being conservative, it's probably more like 15, because then the local sheriff, okay, a guy named John Manchester, notices the car, right? And Palmer, the registrar, says, maybe you should run an ID on who these guys are. So Manchester walks over to the Cadillac, all right? He asked the driver to show him some ID. And the driver took out his driver's license, and he said, what the heck kind of business is that? Because the card said international trademark, all right? I say, so he asked, then asked if he had anything to do with the voter registration drive, and Shaw said he did not, all right? And so then he decided that they really were not one of these agitating groups or anything like that, all right? But he did ask him his name, and he said his name was Clay Shaw, all right? And then he also would, you know, and Ferry, of course, had such a distinctive look to him, you know, with that pasted-on wig and colored-in eyebrows. You know, very hard not to notice him.
Yeah, we should mention, Jim, I don't know if we have gone, I don't recall going into this in any detail in a previous interview, but Ferry had some sort of affliction that was causing all of his hair to fall out, not just the hair on his head, but his eyebrows as well. And he had taken to wearing a garish red wig with, I guess, equally garish drawn-on eyebrows. The point being that aside from the fact that having these three white people, one of them obviously well-heeled and in a black Cadillac, at a voter registration drive for overwhelmingly African Americans in the Deep South in the early 1960s. That would have stood out in and of itself, but David Ferry himself cut a very unusual figure, and it would be remarkable for someone not to remember someone like that, even if they just met them on their own, particularly in the context that you have already set.
Yes, I think it would be pretty much unforgettable, don't you?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. Someone suggested, and I don't know if this was the case or not, but that Ferry, who was an expert flyer, that some people who had flown U-2 planes had experienced that, and it was the result of high-altitude aviation and how that affected some people. And some have speculated maybe at one point Ferry had been involved with something like that. I don't know. But it is, whatever the origin of the affliction, Ferry was losing all of the hair on his body. So, you know, with the red wig, the red drawn on eyebrows, it was pretty tough to miss David Ferry.
Right. I totally agree. Now, as time went on, all right, Oswald finally progressed in line to the point that the registrar, Mr. Palmer, asked him for his identification papers. And Oswald produced what Palmer later called his separation papers from the Marines. They had a local address of New Orleans on the papers. You know, this made it kind of odd. You know, what the heck would Oswald be doing driving 100 miles just to register to vote in a parish where he didn't live? So Palmer now asked Oswald where he lived. He said he lived at the hospital. Palmer then asked him who he was living with there. Now, there's a little bit of confusion as to what Oswald replied, because I've seen two reports. Okay, one said that he said Dr. Pearson, all right? The other one said he said Frank Silva. What's astonishing about this is that both those guys worked at the hospital, both of them, all right? Because the House Select Committee managed to get a list of the doctors on staff at that time, all right? And they were both on it.
And of course, now, this from a guy who has supposedly just decamped from New Orleans to Clinton, Louisiana, to register to vote and is allegedly living at this hospital. How might he have come to be in possession of the two names of actual staff members of the hospital? That is the remarkable
context. You're exactly correct. Now, again, thinking like private investigators, which I think we should be thinking like that, you know, can you imagine if Oswald would have lived and you could have asked him those questions? How did you know about Silva and Pearson both working at that hospital in a place you were never at before, allegedly? How could you know that?
Exactly. Right,
and so then, as I speculate, that one way he could have known it, all right, is that because Silva was born in Cuba from an upper-class family associated with Tulane Medical Center at the time, all right, which was in New Orleans.
And by the way, also was very closely affiliated with Alton Oxner, who in
correct.
Turn, very, very
correct.
Much connected.
Who I'm sure you know who he was, right?
Oh, absolutely. And in some of our previous discussions, not only with you, but I've done many programs with your associate Ed Haslam, who has gone into Alton Oxner and the medical connections at Tulane University. So the link between Oxner and Inca and Ed Butler and, as we'll see, Clay Shaw is something to keep in mind, with Mr. Silva having been associated with Tulane University Medical Center.
Right. Okay. So, in other words, that would be one way through Alton Oxner that they might have known enough to slip him that name. But it also turns out that Silva actually knew Sergio Arcachez Smith, all right? Because during his inquiry, Jim Garrison came across a witness who had been at a gathering at, and I'm sure you know who this guy was, Dr. Robert Heath, who was the chairman of Tulane University Medical School, involved in uses of LSD and MK Ultra. All right?
Right.
And so he said that there was a gathering at Heath's home, and the following event occurred. Silva introduced the man to the former local representative, Howard Hunt's Cuban Revolutionary Council, Sergio Arcachez Smith. Okay?
Yep.
So that's what I mean, you know? Okay, so these are ways that Oswald could have known who these people were. And also, Pearson, the other name, had listed Mr. Silva as a reference on his job application. Now, I'm just going to ask a very simple question. How was it possible that this could have gone undetected by the FBI after Kennedy's assassination? And I'm going to say the same thing I said after Ferry told all those lies of the FBI, is that it's very simple. Hoover wasn't interested. I'm not going to believe he didn't know about it. Okay, I just don't believe that.
Well,
too many people saw them.
Pearson, by the way, is P-I-E-R-S-O-N. A little bit. Most people, P-E-A, like Drew Pearson. But the links between these people, Sergio Arcachez Smith crops up in connection with so many of the different players in the anti-Castro Cuban New Orleans drama, and beyond New Orleans in Texas, we'll come back to him. Someone who looms very large in this entire thing. We also, obviously, it would be impossible for all of this to be coincidence. In connection with your rhetorical question about the FBI, the only way, and the FBI at a field level or street level investigative operation is very effective. They know what they're doing, and they can certainly manifest very great and thorough expertise when they wish to do so. And it's obvious that expertise was being interdicted in this case from some very powerful, powerful interests.
Yes, I completely agree with that.
Now, a lot of people may be wondering, why was Oswald registering to vote? It was suggested that he registered to vote, and you point out in Destiny Betrayed that perhaps getting a job at that hospital would have been one reason that he registered to vote in that area. I wonder if you would tell us about that. And you also have some interesting observations about what his presence at that hospital may ultimately have been designed to convey.
Yes, I agree. It's very difficult to figure this out, all right? It really takes a lot of information and a lot of thinking. But in my opinion, if you follow the chronological trail, that is Oswald coming into town at the barbershop, then going to see State Representative Reeves Morgan, then going to try and sign up to register to vote, then going to the hospital, all right, and having those two names as references. Jim Garrison came to believe that the idea was to get Oswald's name in the personnel papers at the hospital, all right, and then through somebody that they had inside the hospital, which could have been, as we've named a few of them already, all right, to get that person to change the file and bring it over to the patient area. And therefore, once you had that, then you could furnish what was missing from the psychological profile that the Warren Commission was so desperate to portray about Oswald. In other words, that he was truly an unbalanced character. Okay, that's what Jim Garrison came to believe that that whole thing was all about. And I agree with him on that. I think he's correct on that.
In other words, yeah. He was ostensibly registering to vote so he could get a job at the hospital. But
that's what he was thinking.
Yeah, but then later he would have been portrayed as an inmate slash nut, which would have figured into the entire cover story.
Right.
It reminds me of the something we talked about in one of our most recent interviews where part of Ruth Payne's garage sale was a package from George Boole, one of the Dallas White Russian people, containing wrapping paper, which if Oswald had opened, that would have put his fingerprints on the type of wrapping paper he supposedly used to bring the rifle he supposedly used to kill Kennedy into the Texas School Book Depository where his job had been obtained by Ruth Payne. And you mentioned George Boole just happened to live right next door to Jack Ruby. You know, I mean, nothing strange about that. So
nothing.
And one of the things I mentioned to you off mic, Jim, one of the reasons that I wanted to do this long series of interviews, this deep dive, and there may be some listeners wondering, okay, I was spending an awful lot of time on the JFK assassination. Dave's talked about that a lot. Not only does this case, I think, serve to illustrate an awful lot about what our society really is, and in our future talks, talk about how the media behaved in connection with this, but my understanding of that's really where I began my research. I'm in my 40th year on the air, and even long before that, I began researching the JFK assassination and Garrison's investigation and understood that Garrison was right. But the nature of the evidence that I had encountered to date was rather like some very obvious irrigation canals bringing water to cropland in order to irrigate crops. And then with Destiny Betrayed, its second edition, you have sort of flooded the entire field, creating something like a great lake or an inland sea in which all of these players can be seen swimming about in the environment in which they actually lived. And I think that is not only very instructive in terms of conveying to the audience the nature of the society in which they live, but I think it really can give us insight into how our institutions function to keep the truth from us. And then maybe that's to an extent redundant, but we'll get to that and begin to.
I should add then, because later on there was a report that the FBI did show up at the hospital. They showed up within a few days after the assassination. Okay, so that furthers the whole idea of what I'm trying to say, is that the FBI did know about this. But they were not interested. In fact, what they really were interested in was covering it up, right? And again, that goes to a whole different subject. If you want to talk about later, the whole relationship between the Kennedys and J. Edgar Hoover. But to put it mildly, J. Edgar Hoover was not real sad about Jack Kennedy leaving this mortal coil.
No. In fact, in his book, The Plot That Killed King, attorney William Pepper, also now investigating Saran. You mentioned Lisa Peace has a book just released this week about the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Both Kennedys and Martin Luther King, meaning John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, were on what I'm paraphrasing slightly what Pepper phrased, his prayer list. In other words, Hoover was just praying for the deaths of both Kennedy brothers and Martin Luther King. And,
right.
And presents sworn testimony in his book, The Plot That Killed King, that Clyde Polson, whom you alluded to earlier in our last interview, actually was functioning as an on-demand, bringing payments to the forces in Memphis who ultimately slew Martin Luther King. So, yes, that is a remarkable, it's a very important consideration. It really is an extension of so much of what we have seen to date. Just the Castro anti-Castro dichotomy or opposition, with Kennedy doing what he did to normalize relations with Castro, this after the Bay of Pigs, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then shutting down the camps, that would have been a death sentence for JFK in the minds of these people, and not just, you know, Ferry, Bannister, Clay Shaw, people like that, but some very powerful entities. You know, you mentioned H.L. Hunt, Alan Dulles, some really, really nasty people. And so those enmities are indeed very, very important.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
In connection with Ferry and Shaw, an actual planning of the killing of JFK, I'd like to backtrack, Jim, slightly to something that was nicknamed the bomb that Garrison came across, and we alluded to that in our last interview. If you would once again redevelop that for us, because again, David Ferry was Jim Garrison's first investigative target, and then Clay Shaw became the actual defendant in the trial, and what Jimmy Johnson termed, quote, the bomb, unquote, brings the two together, bearing in mind also that when he was interviewed by the FBI, David Ferry claimed that he didn't know how to shoot a rifle.
Right. Which I think is extremely funny, all right, because it's so ridiculous. You alluded to a guy named Jimmy Johnson, all right? Jimmy Johnson was a, let's call him an agent for Jim Garrison, okay? And what happened is that Garrison decided to go ahead and have him be his infiltrator, whatever you want to call it, undercover agent, all right, into Ferry's circle, all right? And so Johnson told Garrison that Ferry kept a manila file folder, which he had labeled the bomb, right? And so one day when Ferry wasn't around, Johnson looked at it, all right? It seemed to be a diagram to plan some kind of assassination attempt. All right, Johnson described as a figure of a man that looked like a bullet hole in the rear of his skull and one on his right shoulder. There was an accompanying illustration from the side with arrows pointing, coming from the back and exiting the throat. There were two lines, one going up to a building and one coming down from the top to form a triangle. The line going up had a marking of 60 feet high. The line coming down was marked 2,500 feet long. And at the bottom of the diagram, there was an airplane, right? The line illustrated the plane coming down over the building, and most people who looked at it said that it appeared to be something like a design for a plot against Castro. All right, since it would be, of course, too dangerous to use a plane within the United States. All right, but later on, as I alluded to earlier, there was a different diagram which appeared to be illustrating just that. That is, a plot to kill Kennedy, all right, in which the witness, a woman named Clara Gay, said that she took it off Ferry's desk, all right, and she saw the two words Elm Street, okay, on the diagram, all right? And she said that she saw what looked to be a diagram of just a drawing of a car from the perspective of an angle from above, and the car was surrounded by high buildings, okay, reminiscent of Dealey Plaza. So, in other words, David Ferry's, it would appear from this evidence that David Ferry's whole vituperativeness and his hatred of Kennedy, you know, eventually manifested themselves in, at the very least, the planning of some kind of assassination plot, all right, around the time that JFK was killed, all right? That's at least what it looks like to me. And if you already had Ferry with Oswald, which we already talked about, it all seems to me a little bit too coincidental, okay? I mean, you got to swallow a lot of stuff to believe this is all an accident.
Indeed, and Shaw once again cropping up in connection with the bomb. In terms of the connections between the initial defendant or investigative target of Jim Garrison, ultimately Clay Shaw, someone who functions as something of a political slash existential glue who ties all of the players in New Orleans together, and beyond that goes all the way back to the Marine Corps and Lee Harvey Oswald, the Marxist Marine, is Kerry Thornley. Again, we're being told this is all coincidence. There was a goofy comedy, which I'm sure you can remember, Jim, called Gomer Pyle, USMC, starring the late Jim Nabors. And one of the signature exclamations that the Neighbors character, Gomer Pyle, who says, "Surprise, surprise!" And you know, when you see Kerry Thornley and all of the places he turns up, that's one of the things that suggests itself to me in an altogether ironic and revealingly ironic context. Kerry Thornley and how he unites Oswald the Marxist Marine with Oswald the anti-Castro, really superficially pro-Castro activist, with all of these people, including Bannister, Ferry, Shaw, et al.
Yes. Kerry Thornley is a character who I believe has been kind of discounted in the past. I found him to be, you know, a pretty interesting guy. You know, because if you take a look, Kerry Thornley goes all the way back with Oswald to the Marine Corps, all right? He was stationed with Oswald, I believe, in two places, one at Atsugi, Japan, and one in Santa Ana, California. He then went ahead and wrote, although they were not both published, he wrote two books. One of them was called The Idle Warriors, and he wrote that before the assassination, but it wasn't published until 1991. And then he wrote a nonfiction book called Oswald, which was published in 1965. And they're both highly incriminating of Oswald. You know, they essentially take the path of the Warren Commission, that Oswald was a maladjusted, sociopathic communist, all right? I mean, I don't think there's any way around that once you read them, you know, which I did, all right? Now, what next happens is that the Secret Service sweeps down on Kerry Thornley in November the 23rd, and in short order, he's on a plane to Washington with his manuscript of the Idle Warriors, all right? All right, and he becomes pretty much the strongest witness for the Warren Commission, saying that Oswald was really a maladjusted nut in the Marine Corps, which, of course, as we mentioned before, does not agree with other people like Jim Botello, right? Now, David Lifton became kind of an acquaintance of Thornley, and it's through Lifton that Garrison brought in Thornley for questioning, all right? Now, before I tell you what he's going to say next, Thornley worked for Kent Courtney, who was a right-wing publisher in New Orleans, who employed CIA journalist Clint Bolton, all right? He was also employed by Alton Oxnard's Inca outfit, which was another right-wing kind of communications outfit, right? And according to Dan Campbell, Thornley was also at 544 Camp Street, all right, in the summer of 1963. Well, when Garrison brings him in for questioning, Thornley denies almost all of these ties, okay? He said he didn't know Bannister, didn't know Ferry, didn't know Clay Shaw, or David Chandler, a famous reporter in New Orleans, okay? And then he's tried to say that he didn't know Oswald, but the problem was that Garrison had something like, I believe, seven witnesses, all right, who had seen the two together in the summer of 1963, you know, at various places. You know, sometimes it would be at Oswald's apartment. Sometimes it would be out. There was a couple witnesses who even said that they saw Thornley with Marina Oswald on more than one occasion. All right? And it actually gets kind of worse then, that one of them actually said that Thornley said that Oswald was not a communist, you know, which kind of blows the whole cover that he's supposed to be there to establish.
Jim, let me jump in at this point. We are almost out of time. We should stress that the aforementioned right-wing media/propaganda activist Kent Courtney had links to Clay Shaw, who was very supportive of him.
Yes, and Bannister.
And Bannister. And this is one of the evidentiary tributaries that unites Oswald and Ferry and Shaw, because, again, Shaw became the next investigative target of Jim Garrison, who ultimately stood trial. We can bear in mind we've got about 2 minutes left. Do you want to talk more about Thornley, Jim, or maybe we can hold this and use this as a beginning to our next interview, and you can tell people about not only the website, but where they can get your books, not only Destiny Betrayed, but JFK, The Evidence Today, and perhaps the recently or just released Lisa Peace book about the RFK assassination, which this is the first I've heard of it, but I have yet to read it, but why don't you tell us about those and Kennedy's and King and Black Op Radio, and we'll take up you know, the surprise of Kerry Thornley in our next interview.
All right. A Lie Too Big to Fail is Lisa Peace's just published volume on the Robert Kennedy case. I wrote the introduction for the book, and I can tell you right now that I believe it's the best book ever published on the Robert Kennedy assassination. So I'd encourage everybody to either go ahead and get it, the actual volume, or get the Kindle version. My website, where you can find all kinds of information about all four assassinations of the 1960s, is called KennedysandKing.com. And if you're interested in my two books, my most recent books, which are Destiny Betrayed, the second edition, which we've been talking about, and the JFK assassination, the evidence today, you can, there's ads that you can punch through there and get those two books. And finally, I'm a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's podcast out of Vancouver, which is called Black Op Radio, which plays on Thursday nights.
Alrighty, so that is where people can go for more information. This concludes For the Record program number 1041, interview number 10 with Jindy Eugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on December 18th of the year 2018. For Jindy Eugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.